I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 204 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crowe with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at infectiousmyth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on PRN.fm or subscribe as a podcast. You can listen to any of the last five episodes at 701-719-0990. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. We have a long interview this week, so let's get right to it. C.D. Mock is the father of Corey Mock, a university wrestler accused of sexual assault and then exonerated. C.D. Mock, my guest today, was once upon a time also a wrestler and then a wrestling coach and is now retired. Welcome to the show, C.D.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And so I called you because you're one of the few people who will talk about a case of a young man who was accused of sexual assault at a university, and then it was determined that it could not be proven. We'll get into the details later. But I also want to talk to you after we talk about Corey's specific case about the more general cases that have been happening, and this is not just an isolated case. So Corey was
not by any means.
Yeah. So Corey was at UTC, University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, on a wrestling scholarship and was a nationally ranked wrestler. And this is the timeline that I got, and you can correct me on anything that I get wrong. So on March 16th, 2014, a classmate, Molly Morris, consented to have sex with him, according to Corey, but she said she was unconscious and raped. April 3rd, she filed a complaint with the university. There was a hearing on June 24th. On August 4th, the judicial officer ruled that Mock was not responsible for sexual misconduct. Under pressure from the university and the complainant, on August 25th, the officer reversed the decision and Mock was expelled, but the decision was put on hold pending an appeal. December 2nd, the university chancellor found him responsible and expelled him. Corey later appealed to the Davidson County Chancery Court and got a temporary injunction, which allowed him to take his fall final exams. January 9th, 2015. That's okay. The court granted a protective order to Corey. January 26th, UTC objects. When they found out that Corey will not graduate, I assume that meant he'd stay an extra year, and they were upset about that. And then August 4th, the judge rules that Corey should not have been expelled. So is that sort of the basic timeline?
Yeah, that's pretty accurate.
So, you know, one of the problems with sexual assault allegations is that, normally sex occurs between two people in private, so there's no witnesses. Was there any external evidence that came into this case? Were there people who saw them going into the room, or were there people who saw them going out of the room, or people who heard anything, or had conversations after the event?
Yeah, there was a lot of that, and that's one of the reasons why in the initial hearing in the school, the judge advocate, who was a accounting professor at UTC, ruled that he was not responsible. In fact, what she ruled, it was a rather lengthy document, what she ruled was that both parties used very poor judgment and made some bad choices that evening, but mm-hmm. there's no way that she could hold anyone single accountable for anything that happened. And I think that was also referenced by the appellate court judge who finalized in the final appeal, went back and referenced that and said that was probably the best advice anybody has given about this, which is probably indicative of most of these issues. There often are witnesses and different pieces of evidence that go along with these. But look, 90-something percent of these cases are he said, she said, and involve alcohol. you know. And
okay,
we
so
need to differentiate.
Yeah. So the judge advocate said bad choices. So I presume that means they were both drinking.
Correct.
Were there any witnesses who agreed with the complainant that she said she was unconscious, like drunk to the point
no.
of blacking out, or?
No, in fact, quite the contrary. There were numerous witnesses who indicated she was not drunk or didn't appear drunk. No one can say what someone is or isn't, but indicated that she didn't appear to be drinking a lot and that she didn't appear to be, drunk or had drank too much. The witnesses were all pretty much confirmed my son's story of the evening. And, it's very rare to find any of these instances where in the initial hearing, the accused is found to be not responsible.
Right.
Very rare.
Right, because
he was found to be not responsible initially tells you that there wasn't a whole lot of evidence against him in that hearing.
But the same officer reversed the decision, and did the officer explain why? I think it was a woman. Why she overruled her own decision?
Only there was no additional evidence, no additional information. However, her comment when she made the change speaks volumes. And what she basically said was that she had been asked to reconsider, and she is reconsidering. And her rationale was that there was no evidence that he obtained affirmative consent.
Oh,
so you have to
okay.
go. You have to look at the, when you look at the timeline of this. You have to realize that this was one of the. You know, this is back when this all started on college campuses.
Right.
And you know, universities at that time were not experienced in this, particularly some of the smaller ones.
Right.
They didn't know about the Dear Colleague letter. They didn't understand the processes here. So we believe that once she made that ruling. The attorneys at the college level, who get paid to protect the universities, the attorneys got involved, and the attorneys basically said, "Hey, wait a minute, you don't want the Department of Education in here poking around,
right.
You have a lot to lose here, and the chancellor and whoever, I don't know, I don't have facts on what happened after that. We don't know, but what we do know is she just abruptly, after a couple of weeks, changed her decision with no real explanation.
Well, I think it is true that universities are under a lot of pressure to do something about the perceived problem of a crisis of sexual assault on campus. And whenever a campus found somebody not responsible or whatever, however they described it, there was outcry that another rapist had gone unpunished, more people now are talking about the concept of due process, innocent until proven guilty. A lot of people have said, well, if a few young men get kicked out of school, in order that more rapists get punished, it's not really a big deal. They're not being punished that badly. So can you talk about the impact to your family, to your son, obviously, but also to yourself and the rest of your family going through this, what looks like a one-year process?
Yeah. But let me also say, start that though, I'll answer your question, but let me just say that our situation was nothing. Frankly, compared to what many of these young men have gone through. And I'm involved now in a number of organizations to the extent that I counsel or work with some of these people and help them to understand what's happening and what their resources are. So I'm intimately involved with a number of these young men. So I'd rather than I'll tell you about our situation. We were floored. We didn't know anything about this. When I heard about it, I thought, okay, you know, sounds like a he said, she said, and I was very upset at my son. I thought that he made some horrible decisions that evening,
right.
For a lot of reasons. But you know, it's one thing to make some bad moral decisions and bad choices. It's another thing to, you know, to rape someone or sexually assault someone.
Right.
We felt, my wife and I felt pretty comfortable after talking with him and after also hearing her testimony that he hadn't really done anything wrong. He certainly hadn't broken the law.
Right.
And we felt comfortable that this was going to go away until we began to get an education about what was going on at the college level. Some of the changes that Obama administration had made through the Department of Education.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got a little nervous because we realized we were kind of fighting City Hall, and it didn't have to make sense, and it didn't have to be fair. It just is what it is. So my son was actually afforded a number of due process rights at his college that you know, we're thankful for, and that very, very few young men that I've worked with mm-hmm. have received. So in many respects, we were lucky, we were fortunate. We're also fortunate because we could fight it. So to answer your question, for those people that make that assertion that, oh, well, what if a few people go, you know, get in trouble, you know, if it kids rape us off the street or out of the colleges, then it's a good thing. Well, you know, first of all, that's contrary to the founders of our Constitution, who said that, you know, it'd be better for, you know, for nine guilty men to go free than one innocent man to go to prison. So it's a completely mm-hmm. different value system than that which our country was founded upon, and that which our process, our laws dictate. Imagine taking any other example, whether it be burglary or any other criminal activity, and applying the same rules to. Bottom line is, what happens to the young man? Let's take a quick example. Okay, mm-hmm. I'm on campus. I'm paid for school. Maybe I'm a junior in college. I get accused. Immediately, you are kicked off campus.
Right.
On accusation, my son was removed from his wrestling team. On accusation. Just mm-hmm. on accusation. Okay? And they all are. Nobody's allowed to do anything like that. Then they are removed from campus because they don't want the alleged victim to be afraid of retaliation or further problems from the alleged accused rapist.
Right.
So you got this. You got the young man who's now removed. He's got, in order to fight this, two things have to happen. One, legitimately, he has to have money.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't got $30,000 or $40,000, as most of the people that I have talked to and worked with in this process, you can't fight it. You mm-hmm. just walk away. People say, oh, big deal. It's not like you go to jail. Okay, so
right.
You got a young man who started his life and his career in a certain direction through school. He can't go back to college.
Could you go to another college?
No, you can't. You because that's on your transcript, and the colleges won't take it off your transcript. Try to get a college to let somebody in who's got a sexual assault violation on their transcript. They're never going to let him in, and that's what's happened. So he can't go to another college. His life has been turned completely upside down. Now, look, if he raped somebody or sexually assaulted somebody, that's the way it should be. No question, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about falsely accused people.
Right, and also, like, another thought I have is that if there was allegations of criminal behavior, then why should it not be handled by the criminal justice system? Like,
because the Obama administration said it shouldn't be. I mean, that's why. The Obama administration weaponized the schools. In fact, threatened the schools, which is why mm-hmm. most of these schools are responding the way they're responding. They're not responding this way because they feel some philosophical responsibility to protect women. They're responding the way they're responding because the Obama administration said, if you don't go after these young men, I'm paraphrasing, If you don't make sure, based on these constraints, and they set up a policy for how it should be done, if you don't do it, we could come in and take your federal funding. You remove
right.
the school, that's like saying we're going to put you out of business. Just think for a second. You're a school. What are you going to do? You're going to take a chance? You're going to, if you throw this young man under a bus and you support this woman 100%, and by the way, the accuser doesn't pay for anything. The attorneys are put up by the school. Everything's paid for. They don't have any, they got nothing in the game. Okay? Unless they've actually been sexually assaulted. But again, we're not talking about that. So,
right.
you know, the Obama administration weaponized these schools and said, this is what you need to do if you don't do it. And we find that you don't do it. If that victim, alleged victim, files a Title IX complaint and we find that you did not effectively follow these rules to go after this young man, accused young man, then there's a chance you could lose your federal funding. So you can't blame the schools, although I think they're spineless, most of the administrators. It is what it is. I mean, they're also business people. Money matters. And that's the motivation. Make no mistake.
Of course, they wouldn't want to admit that. So does Title IX say that the university must support the accuser and not the accused, so that the accuser gets
Absolutely.
Lawyers and gets participation
yep.
in the process? I mean, is the accused sometimes denied the right to be part of the investigation?
Yes. Absolutely. In fact, like, for example, I'll give you one example. Okay, we have a fundamental principle of due process in our country, and that is that you have a right to face your accuser. You have a right to hear what your accuser is saying about you.
Mm-hmm.
The Obama administration took that away and said, in fact, we encourage you not to allow the accused to face the accuser. It's too stressful for the accuser.
Which presupposes that all accusers are making legitimate accusations. In your experience, how many of these accusations, I guess I would divide them into three categories. There are those that are legitimate cases of sexual assault, and there are false accusations, but there are also maybe misunderstandings. For example, having a couple of beers, making a bad decision to have sex with somebody, waking up the next morning sober and saying, why did I do that? Which would sort of be in the middle of, you know, an understanding of what is actually sexual assault. How do these things fit into those categories?
Well, in my opinion, and I think this is what you're asking, correct me if I'm wrong, but I personally think that the vast majority of these false accusations are not women who are just mean and want to hurt men. You know, I think the vast majority of these, I mean, I'll give you an example. In my son's case, okay, the girl had absolutely, and she testified to this, so I'm not putting words in her mouth. She testified that she had absolutely no intention ever of going to the authorities and lodging a complaint. She felt like, okay, look, I went there, I drank a little bit, it was late at night, it was a party. You know, I did go into the bedroom. You know, he didn't drag me in there. I went into the bedroom. You know, she made this. This is the comment she made. She testified to this
right.
fact. So I felt some responsibility. But, and this is, I'm telling you, you look at most of these cases, and this is what happens. But over the next couple of weeks, I got to thinking about it. And my roommate one day asked me what was wrong because I seemed a little depressed. And I told her, well, I slept with somebody and I feel guilty about it. And my roommate worked for the Rape Crisis Center.
Mm-hmm.
And my roommate looked at me and said, did you say yes? Because if you didn't say yes, doesn't matter what you did, if you did not say yes, that's rape.
Okay, so let's talk about affirmative. Let's talk about affirmative consent. Because I think there's a big discussion going on about what is consent in the case of sex. And some people are pushing the notion that every step of the process has to be an affirmative Can I kiss you? Yes. Can I take off your clothes? Yes. And there has to be a yes at every stage. But I don't believe that that's the law anywhere. If two people want to have sex completely silently, like sometimes happens in the movies, without any words, under the logic of affirmative consent, that would be illegal.
Well, let's first of all, we have to be clear. When you say law, all right, there's a difference between the law, as in civil law or criminal law, versus how college campuses are run. So
right.
Specifically, you know, we're talking about college campuses, and in fact, that is the law on most college campuses.
Affirmative
most
consent.
Most college campuses, that's correct. And affirmative consent, for lack of a better, I don't want to sound unintelligent, but that's the dumbest concept that I've ever heard of. It's a concept as good as intentions may be. And we've got a lot of good intentions out there to try to fix what will forever probably be a problem between men and women, and particularly on college campuses, for a lot of reasons that we could talk about for days. But the problem exists in our society. But the solution, so whoever is the knuckleheads that came up with the solution of affirmative consent, you have basically created a system that is doomed to failure. It's not possible for it to succeed. And if you think it is, if anyone, and I've challenged feminists on this, explain to me how affirmative consent works, and explain to me the process so that I know, as a man, how that works. No one has ever been able to explain that. They try, but they can't do it. Because even
right,
when you say every step in the process, your definition of what a step is in the process is different than somebody else's definition of a step. There's no defined rules to guide it. It's totally ambiguous.
Right, and I think normally when there's passion between two people, people do things unspoken. Somebody moves a body part towards somebody else to indicate that they want that piece of clothing taken off or whatever. I mean, a lot of it is unspoken. And, you know, it would basically mean that you'd have to record every sexual encounter so that you could verify afterwards that, yes, she didn't kiss me without asking first. And is this asymmetrical?
I don't mean to interrupt you, but let's take it another way. What you're saying is all true, but let's just assume we have two people that completely agree affirmative consent's a good idea.
Right.
How do they carry that out? You just used a good example, taping. Taping doesn't work because here's what they'll say. And this has been said. This has been done. This has all been tried. You take out your cell phone and you videotape the young lady saying, yes, I would like to have sex with you. Okay?
Right.
If you turn the phone off, she can say 5 seconds later, I changed my mind.
Right. I say. Right.
Okay, yeah, you have to leave the tape running. You have to leave the tape running and literally tape the event in order to prove that, in fact, there was actual consent. I mean, there isn't any way, this is the point, there isn't any possible, reasonable way, with the exception of taping the entire event, start to finish, of proving consent.
Right, and yet...
Then when you bring alcohol into the mix, you got a whole nother problem.
Well, one thing the court said in Corey's case was that Corey was being required to prove that a crime didn't happen. And so when the affirmative consent rule is applied, as it was applied on August 25th, and they kicked him out, they said he did not get an affirmative consent. They didn't know that he didn't get affirmative consent. It just wasn't proven that he did. But again, that's turning the system on its head. If affirmative consent was going to be applied, you would have to somehow prove that it didn't happen. And again, when these events happen in private, and it's he said, she said, how could you possibly know?
Yeah, and just so you're clear, just so we're all clear, in his case, and in many of these cases, and in fact, a lot of the recent rulings have been the same way. It isn't that he couldn't prove that there was consent or there was consent. The issue with the courts outside of colleges, the issue is that he was put in a position to prove he got consent, which is counter to our law of due process. They tried to, they put him in a position of proving his innocence. And that's not the way it's done. It's not on him to prove his innocence, it's on them to prove his guilt. And that's where the due process comes into play.
Right. And as you said, the complainant herself seemed to think at first, for the first while, like a month maybe, that she had just kind of made a bad decision. And as you say, people make bad decisions all the time. And then it was turned into the belief that affirmative consent is the law, and that therefore this was sexual assault because she didn't say yes at every point. But I mean, was that, I mean, that seemed to have come out afterwards in the whole process. I mean, was she thinking, on March the 17th, that things happened without me saying yes to everything? Was that in her head? It seems like that was planted, that idea was planted later.
Yeah, I can't, I don't know what was in her head.
Yeah,
I don't really know what she said. And, my rationale of this, and this is, again, is not just this one case, but many of these cases, it's, like you said, people make bad decisions, particularly when they have alcohol or been influenced. And, and later on they regret it. And no one likes to take responsibility for making bad decisions. It's a lot easier to put blame on someone else. That may sound cold, but that's what a lot of these things are, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. I have no idea what was in her head or what, but that's what it sounds
right.
like.
Right. We can't really know, but I don't think that too many people intuitively think I need affirmative consent. That seems like a very legalistic way to think about a very emotional process. Having sex with somebody else, you don't want to think about it in a series of steps.
And if you talk to most college kids today, and again, I worked on a college campus for 15 years, you talk to most of the kids in college campuses today, especially guys, they don't know anything about this. I mean, you talking to them about affirmative consent, and they'll laugh at you. They'll, what? What are you talking about? What?
Yes.
If we're in that situation, it's because we both want to be in that situation. I'm not going to put a girl in that situation. I mean, that's how all my wrestlers responded. They're like, Coach, why would we want to have sex with somebody who didn't want to have sex? I mean, that's their response. They just think it's common sense, and this is what the Obama administration didn't get, and that's why a lot of this was, in my opinion, driven by a very progressive feminist force that was hell bent on swinging the pendulum as far possible the other way.
Right, because I think there have been many cases where women's complaints have not been taken seriously, and I think it's been asserted that a woman or a man can say no at any point, and if the man continues or, prevents her from leaving, this can occur also in same-sex relationships, but let's just talk about a man and a woman, then that would clearly be sexual assault beyond the point where the first no occurred. And doesn't have to be... Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that. So I would ask you, and maybe your listeners would answer this themselves as well, what's wrong with no means no?
Yeah,
because this is important to understand as to why affirmative consent ever even became a reality. I mean, the only thing wrong with no means no is when a girl is inebriated. That's the problem, and that's why no means no stopped becoming something that that's why affirmative consent took over for no means no. Because it all is based on alcohol and drugs.
Well,
when no means no, when a girl is inebriated, she can't say no.
Well, yeah,
so
and
people
I
wanted to protect them.
Right, but I mean, we can protect people who are so drunk that they cannot speak, or you know, are obviously severely drunk. They can't stand up. They can't make
okay,
a sentence.
Okay, I got to interrupt you. Interrupt you, Dave, because no, we can't. We can't protect them. And the administration, and the Title IX people, and the government, and the schools have proven that we can't protect those people because what they have done is said, if a girl, and I'm going to use girl boy here because that's typically what it is, if a girl
right.
has drank any alcohol, at that point it's impossible to get consent. That's what's played out in college campuses today everywhere. There are posters all over college campuses.
But what about the guy? I mean, it's so does this mean...
He's guilty.
Right,
guilty.
So this...
Totally guilty.
So this means that a married couple go out for dinner, they drink a bottle of wine before them, they go home, have sex, that they both rape each other? I mean, is it impossible to have consensual sex when you've had a drink?
Well, in the courts, outside of the schools, yeah, it's very possible. And that's not the law. The courts
right.
don't say that if both people are drinking, it's the guy's fault.
Right.
I'm not telling you that. I'm just telling you what's going on college campuses.
Right.
That's as crazy as that sounds. That's reality. And the reason that's reality is because they can't figure out how to protect women when they drink.
I just saw a court decision related, I think it was University in Ohio, where there was evidence that both the man and the woman, the boy and the girl, were drunk to the point that they could not consent. But in one decision, it was only the state of the girl that was considered, and the court said, no, you have to consider the state of both parties. But I mean, what do you do in the case where you could argue that neither party is able to form consent? Like, did they both rape each other, or what do we do? That seems like it gets into some crazy territory.
Yeah, I get blamed all the time. They call it victim blaming. I have a daughter and I have a son, one of each.
Right.
And I don't feel any stronger about my son being falsely accused as I do of my daughter being sexually assaulted. I'm a dad.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you this. I raised my children differently. And any father who would say differently, who has a son and a daughter, I think they're lying. I raised my daughter differently. I didn't tell my son that if he was out at a party to make sure that when he left that party that he was always with people. There's different rules. And see,
yes.
People don't want to hear that. They say, oh, you're victim blaming. There shouldn't be different rules. Look, in a perfect world, you're right. There shouldn't be different rules. But
right.
as a father, my daughter needs to have different rules because my son's 6'2", 200 pounds, and he can take care of himself. And my daughter can't.
Yeah, I have two daughters, and I also felt more uncomfortable because it's, you know, sexual assault is normally a man against a woman, and obviously the size of a man is usually bigger than the woman, and when people get drunk, they do things that they will regret later, minor things or major things. That doesn't mean that if, you know, one of our daughters was raped, that it was her fault. But I think that trying to avoid cases where you're vulnerable, I mean, it may not be sexual assault. I mean, you may be so drunk that somebody steals your purse or, you know, they humiliate you. They take videos of you know, doing things to you while you're drunk, which aren't sexual assault, but are humiliating because you got to the point where you were completely inebriated or otherwise.
Well, you're applying common sense to real life situations, and unfortunately that's not what has been done in these rules and regulations on college campuses. That, you know, I don't have a solution for a lot of these things. I don't have a solution. I know what doesn't work, you know, and I can argue that easily. But I do know that what we all need to do is stop pushing our agendas and just start applying some basic, solid, good common sense to the situation.
I mean,
and you know, people.
I was just going to talk about Betsy DeVos. Like, I'm not a Betsy DeVos fan. I think she's trying to push an agenda of privatizing the U.S. school system, but I think that what she's doing around Title IX reform is probably good. I think that, you know, some politicians do some really bad things and some really good things, and you know, progressives are saying everything she does is bad. But I think, you know, legal experts are saying that, you know, this is what we need. We need to have a balance between the accused and the accuser.
Well, you know, look, you can disagree with Betsy DeVos and some of her, you know, some of the things that she does. But here's the difference as I see it. And I don't know Betsy DeVos. I don't know about what you just said. I'm not involved in that. What I do know is that when the Obama administration put out the Dear Colleague letter in, I think it was 2012, that instituted most of these problems, there was no public comment period. None. It
really?
Was just forced down everybody's throat. None. No one, none. Okay? And they did no research. They didn't ask questions. They just did it. The difference is not only are we having a public comment period where everybody, both sides, can comment and talk about it, but before she did this, she took the time to meet with numerous falsely accused young men and their family to find out what's really going on. What is this? What's these people's perspective? Because the other side doesn't need much of a perspective. We all agree rape is bad, sexual assault is bad, women need to be protected. Nobody in their right minds doesn't agree with that. Everybody agrees with that. We all know that. But the other side was not very public, and the main reason it wasn't very public is because most of these people don't come out. Like you said, I'm one of the few, you know, I do a lot of interviews. I was just on Fox News last week. I do interviews because we're already out there. We don't have anything to lose.
Right.
But once you get out there and once you get in Google land, it follows you forever. It doesn't matter that you're innocent or that you won your court case. It makes no difference. There's a label that sticks. And nobody wants that, understandably. So the ones you've heard of, you're just scraping the bottom of the barrel. There's so many, there's hundreds of these situations throughout the country that nobody ever hears about.
And some of them that have resulted.
She's trying to do her homework, is my point.
Right. Some of them that have resulted in a settlement have presumably had a confidentiality clause. Or is it just that, you know, once you get the settlement, you just want to go away and hide and hope that it the stench stays away from you?
Oh, no. Make no mistake. Colleges don't settle without a confidentiality clause because that's all they care about. I mean, colleges don't care about money. They don't care about the money. They don't care about the suits. They don't care about making payments. What the colleges care about is PR. That's all they care about. And they want to make sure that their donors are not calling them on the phone saying, hey, what are you doing to these young men?
Yes. Can you sketch out a couple of cases of young men that you've dealt with and describe, you know, some of the different situations that have occurred and what's happened to these young men and how you believe it's not been a just process?
Well, the extreme case is one committed suicide.
Yes.
You know, these guys get on campus. They're not allowed to talk about it, but the accuser is.
Mm-hmm.
And the accuser, if they're vindictive enough, they make it very clear to all their friends and everybody on campus that, you know, that this individual sexually assaulted me. And they end up having, you know, no social life, no friends. They're walking around campus feeling like a rapist. They don't feel they did anything wrong, whether it's a misunderstanding or whatever the situation is. they go into depression, state of depression. Their parents are far away. They can't really help. They try to get them help. If they have money, they get them to a therapist. Many of them do that. Some can't afford a therapist. Some think they don't need a therapist, and they do need a therapist. And, they, you know, it's just an utter state of depression. I mean, my son is a very strong personality. He's a wrestler. He was very confident, extremely confident. And he felt, 100% felt that he did not do anything that he was being accused of doing. He understood he made some mistakes, drinking, some other things, but, you know, not anywhere near to the extent that. And he stayed on campus his entire senior year, basically stayed in his room and went to class. Mm-hmm. Was not allowed to wrestle. They took his senior year away from him. He's been wrestling his whole life. Yeah, was ranked fourth in the country going into his senior year. It was an opportunity for him to, you know, to fulfill his dream. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it is what it is. I mean, you know, the point is even he was depressed. And there was a time when, you know, my wife said to me, look, you need to bring him home. You know, and I called him and said, maybe you should come home. Let's just move on. We don't need to do this. You know, it's very difficult. It's very difficult. Now the feminists will say, well, it's not anywhere near as difficult as somebody getting raped. I agree. You know, that's not really the issue. The issue is we're talking about falsely accused people who did not rape. And, you know, for them, it's a horrendous experience. For their parents, it's horrendous. You know, they're complete mercy of the system. If they have money, then they have some power. But
it's
the injustice of our justice system is you need money to have power.
It's often pointed out that women who are sexually assaulted suffer through their life from flashbacks, especially when they end up in a similar situation as where they were raped or whatever. It has a permanent negative impact on their life, and at least it can.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like these false accusations can also similarly traumatize somebody for life. You know, feelings of what I lost and how unfair it was, and things, those kinds of feelings. Plus, you know, real lost opportunities, perhaps being unable to go to graduate school or unable to, you know, go into sports competitions or whatever it is that was lost. Can
yeah,
you
which
describe?
Granted, I agree. Which pale in comparison to being raped. I mean, I agree with that certainly, but nevertheless, there's not one single family, not one that I've worked with or even known about that has not experienced extreme trauma in this situation. It's a horrible thing to go through. Whether it's this or any other kind of false accusation. I mean, if you know an innocent person being accused of something is a horrible thing and can be very traumatic.
Did your son's friends stand by him, or did he lose a lot of friends over this?
No, my son was very fortunate. He had the support of the wrestling team, and those were, for the most part, his friends. You know, what he couldn't do, which frankly didn't bother me a bit, is he couldn't go to parties, he couldn't have much of a social life. And what I told him is, hey, you know, there are consequences to decisions, and that's just how it is. You can't be somewhere and have them take pictures of you, and, you know, somebody will promote that. You know, Vice Magazine did an article in January of 2015, and that article was an interview of Molly Morse, and she interviewed, named names, came out, told everything from her perspective. And, you know, that was my first experience. I'm thinking, you know, no one would do something like that in a magazine or a news. You know, now in hindsight, I feel like an idiot. I was naive. But I'm thinking the media is not going to just take one side. They're going to want, you know, they're going to do some investigation. They're going to want all sides. They're not promoting an agenda. Vice Magazine, written by some woman named Luther, it was the worst piece of journalism I've ever seen in my life. It was just complete and total biased feminism. And that's what really motivated me. I mean, in hindsight, I should
They didn't try because, to talk to your son?
No. Didn't care. All they wanted to do was tell the story and promote the agenda. And, you know, you can Google the magazine article and read it. I mean, it was totally from her perspective. every single accusation or anything was completely her perspective, as if it was facts.
I also think that in some of these cases, the young women kind of get drawn into, now I've made this accusation, I got to stick with it, because they would lose a lot of face if they suddenly said, you know, this has all been a big mistake.
Yeah, I don't really blame them. I blame the support that they get. You know, the minute that a young lady makes an accusation, she has an incredible amount of resources that at her disposal, who will help her through the process. A lot of these groups, that's what they do. Whether it's paying for, you know, for if they have to pay for attorneys, they have to pay for their defense or anything like that. You know, they get help. There's a network now. You know, things have changed in the last 2 years. You still with me?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm
still here. Keep
you know,
going.
A lot's changed in the last few years. It's things have changed. It's not where it was. And when this happened to us, I didn't know of any resources. I had no, you know, there wasn't anyone to help. I had no idea.
Right.
I had to learn all this on my own. And I found this organization, this little organization in North Carolina called the National Coalition for Men. And the president of that organization in Charlotte, North Carolina, his son was falsely accused at the University of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And he was incredibly helpful to me.
Right.
Really, without him, I don't know how I would have made it. And then there's another organization in Washington, D.C. called FACE, Families Advocating for Campus Equality, run mm-hmm. by, for the most part, women, mothers of falsely accused young men, and many of the mothers are attorneys.
Mm.
And many of them are incognito. Many of them have not come out. So, you know, they're quietly fighting the fight through the legislative process. And they have made tremendous progress in this. And so, you know, it's a better situation now than it was, obviously, by what Betsy DeVos is doing. People are recognizing that, you know, the pendulum, you know, there was a problem. The problem needs to be addressed. But the pendulum has swung way too far, and we just need to bring it back by recognizing that you can't throw due process out the window because you've got a strong motivation to fix a problem.
As the consequences are quite severe. I mean, it's not like in the past, you know, the sort of the traditional black man accused of raping a white woman goes to jail, gets the death penalty. Obviously, we're talking about something different. But we're still talking about lifetime consequences. There was a case in Canada where a group of dental students had like some little Facebook group where they made really obnoxious comments about the women in the same class, like which ones they wanted to have sex with, which ones were ugly, things like that. And they were threatened with being kicked out of dental school, you know, in the middle of the process. So that would have meant that their dream of becoming a dentist would have been derailed by, again, some really bad decisions, which aren't criminal, but still, for the rest of their life, they would remember that I'm not a dentist because, you know, I got in this group where we said some horrible things, but didn't actually do anything. Interestingly, we're at a time, you probably know of the case of Jeffrey Epstein, the billionaire who flew airplanes full of young girls down to his Caribbean island with powerful people on the airplane and had sex with minors. And he got a slap on the wrist after his case, which I guess goes to show the inequality of the justice system. Can you talk about another case
for sure.
That's kind of illustrative?
Another case, sure. You know, they're all pretty much the same. That was an extreme, obviously,
taking
his own life, horrible for the family. But most of these cases are pretty much the same. It's a lengthy process. Your life goes on hold. Your life stops for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to a father today in Texas, and his son attends a school in Texas. And they, you know, they found him responsible. They wouldn't even give him. They kicked him off campus. They wouldn't even tell him what the accusations were against him.
Mm-hmm.
His father got an attorney. They wouldn't let the attorney come to the hearing. So the schools do not have to give you the right to have an attorney or be represented by an attorney. Many of them mm-hmm. don't. And most of them, if the attorney is allowed to come, he's allowed to come, but he cannot say anything, and he certainly cannot question the accuser. The accuser's rarely there. That's what happened to him. He was brought in. They wouldn't even tell him what the accusations were. All they told him was, you've been accused of sexual assault. They didn't give any details, didn't tell him who accused him or anything else. And he took him months to find that out. In the meantime, he's kicked off campus. He's now in a situation, about a year's gone by, he's now in a situation where he just had final exams. They tried to, they told him he couldn't go to final exams. He had to go to the local court and get a stay to stay the school from keeping him from his final exams because he planned to appeal it. And he convinced the judge, we're not going to settle for this. We're going to appeal this. And if they don't let him take his final exams, they're doing him irreparable harm, which is what all the schools try to do. Look, the schools are motivated to do. It's not, you know, I can't believe I'm even saying this because it's not how I feel, but it is reality. they're not trying to hurt young men. I mean, that's not their role, and they certainly don't want to be in that role. I've talked to many administrators, athletic directors of numerous schools. They hate this. They mm-hmm. hate it. They know it's wrong. But they can't do anything about it. It's being weaponized by the government, being pushed by the government. So the schools are in a situation where what they want to do is they want to create a history of being able to prove to the department, to the Civil Rights Office and the Department of Education, if they come in and investigate them, that they did everything in their power to believe the accuser.
Well, I guess that's really the problem, because if they did everything in their power to investigate the allegations, and sometimes they decided they were warranted and sometimes not, that's one thing. But it appears that they have to do everything in their power to prove the accusations.
Yeah, hopefully that's what we're getting to. Hopefully we're getting to a state where accused are given proper due process protections, and schools are doing some semblance of investigating. I agree with you and what you earlier said. I don't believe the school should be in this business. I think it's insane. I mean, we could sit here and talk. You know, the next thing is talk about the people who have gotten rich over all of this. There are people out there who have gotten unbelievably wealthy over this because they are getting money from the schools to set up programs that are supposed to educate students about these things, which is, it's just total crap. It's not even good information. But the schools don't. It's not their money, and they want to look like they're doing something.
Right.
So,
I mean,
then you've got Title IX officers making, you know, $150,000, $200,000 a year. You know, these are people. These are educators, people who went through an educational system, and you know they're making hundreds of thousands of dollars at the university level, being Title IX officers.
And if there were no cases,
pardon me?
I was just going to say, if there were no cases for these Title IX officers, then somebody would say, why are we paying all this money?
You got it. I mean, that's right. I mean, I doubt we'll ever get to that point unless they. You know, unless they say that this is a crime and it needs to go to the criminal courts entirely. You know, I don't think they're ever going to take some responsibility. You know, a lot of one of the arguments, the criticism of Betsy DeVos is, the changes that she's making is that the schools, the universities have been petitioning for years that they don't want this responsibility. They don't want the liability.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to get sued. You know, they want to be taken out of the picture. And a lot of this is to do that, is to remove some of the responsibility of this from the schools, which would be good for everybody.
Yes, yes, I think so. Well, we're running close to an hour. We're running out of time, so I'd just like to give you an opportunity to close on something you think is important. There's some things that we
sure.
didn't talk about that we should have.
Sure. Get on my quick soapbox.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you know, I think that what we would be better served as human beings whatever our capacity is in this situation. I think we would be better served and better serve our fellow man. Is to take a step back and instead of trying to address the symptoms, try to address the cause. And you know, the cause of what's happened on of all of this hysteria, whether it's campus rape hysteria or whatever. You know, let's face it, the cause of this is a degradation of society, of morals. And, you know, when you've got a, you know, how do you control sexual activity on a college campus when, you know, when there's a, when it's a, everybody's hooking up? You know, and that's what's happening on college campuses. I mean, you know, there's no longer a real romance, or it doesn't have to be any kind of a romance to a physical relationship. It's just deemed to be, I'm not obviously saying everybody, but I'm saying, you know, compared to when I was in school, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know, you dated a girl and you dated a guy and you got to know them. And, you know, you had an investment in this before there was going to be any kind of physical activity. And today, it's completely the opposite. They don't want the commitment. They don't want the responsibility. They don't want relationship. They just want quick pleasure. How are we trying to manage the rules around that? It's
well,
crazy.
You know, yes.
And we could argue, you know, why are we in that situation? I mean, in my view, I'm sure your listeners probably don't want to hear this, particularly in New York, but in my view, we've strayed away from, you know, our Christian roots, our Christian Judaic roots, and our, you know, the kind of values that our founding fathers instilled in this country, in my opinion. And I feel like we don't get back to some of that, which I guess we probably won't. We're going to continue to have problems like this.
Well, I'm not terribly religious myself, but I do feel that relationships are important, and that sex divorced from a relationship is not really a good thing. I mean, I think it's natural that, you know, young people, when they're released from the sheltered environment of their homes and they're exposed to lots of people of the opposite sex or the same sex, if that's their predilection, and there's lots of alcohol and drugs, that, you know, a lot of careless and stupid things are going to happen. But we need to separate the stupid things from the illegal things. You know, people that have sex with somebody and then regret it the next day versus people who are sexually assaulted when they're out cold drunk, things like that. Anyway, I would like to thank you for sharing your experiences and your thoughts with me today.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. Goodbye then.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to episode 204 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a question or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Until next week, thank you and goodbye.